From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Governor Larry Hogan announced Monday he has advanced aggressive non-Hodgkin lymphoma and is undergoing treatment. He also said he'll remain on the job. We talked with a few cancer experts about managing cancer in the workplace. Then 2 months ago, Devin Allen was an aspiring photographer in Baltimore. Then a picture he made during the unrest landed on the cover of Time magazine. We talk with him about a new exhibit of his work coming to the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. Plus, Bert Cumero, head of the Maryland Historical Society, is stepping down from that role after 5 years. Tom Hall talks to him about efforts to make Maryland history come alive today. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Governor Hogan shared a lot at his press conference Monday. He went beyond announcing that doctors have diagnosed him with an advanced aggressive form of cancer of the lymph nodes. He told us the cancer already has spread to dozens of spots in his body, that he doesn't feel much pain, but he doesn't have much appetite, that the aggressive chemo his doctors plan will take a little over 4 months, and that the experts gave him good odds of surviving the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and clearing it from his body. Perhaps the message he underscored most often was that he intends to keep working while he's undergoing treatment.
The fact is, I'm just like the more than 70,000 people diagnosed with lymphoma every single year who fight it, beat it, and continue doing their jobs at the same time.
Since Governor Hogan is the boss, he may have more say than many workers in how his cancer treatment plays out at the office. Johns Hopkins Medicine has recently launched a program called Managing Cancer at Work, a wellness benefit employers can purchase to offer free to their workers. And with us to talk about the issues cancer raises for workers, caregivers, and their managers is one of the cancer experts who designed the new program, Lily Shockney, a registered nurse who is administrative director of the Johns Hopkins Breast Center and director of cancer survivorship programs. She's also survived 2 bouts with breast cancer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also here is Laurie Singer Sievers, a filmmaker and TV producer who serves on the advisory board of the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center and produces their education and caregiver videos. Welcome back to the show, Laurie.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Lily Shockney, some people may have heard the governor describing his diagnosis and his determination to take minimal time away from work and wondered how realistic that was. How common is it for workers to continue at work while they're being treated for cancer?
I think the commonness is growing, and I think that's actually a good thing. Whatever we can do to maintain normalcy while undergoing cancer treatment, that actually from a mental health perspective is a smart thing to do, and also physically is a smart thing to do.
Physically too?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
Because normalcy reduces our stress. We're adding one stressor, which is the cancer diagnosis and treatment. Whatever we can do to maintain normalcy with the rest of our life will reduce our anxiety.
There are a lot of elements to this program, Managing Cancer at Work. What's the best way to describe it to people, what you're doing with this program?
So it is an employee benefit. We decided that it was something important that we wanted to do for our own Johns Hopkins family employees. We recognize the fact that 1 in 2 men and 1 in 3 women will be diagnosed with a life-threatening cancer sometime in their lifetime. More than 40% of those individuals are under the age of 65 and working full-time outside of their home in a business. So we also know that from a financial perspective, it's very difficult for people to take off large blocks of time. I don't think that very many people plan to get cancer, despite the fact that those statistics I just gave are very real, but people need their paycheck whole, they need their health insurance intact, and their second family are the people that they work with, including their boss and their coworkers. So that's part of their support system as well.
So why did you see that there was a need for a special program to walk cancer patients, their caregivers, and their managers through through what?
Yes, what we learned, and we did focus groups and actually some research as well in taking a look at this particular issue, is that for the most part, managers have no idea what to say or how to support their employee. Employees don't even realize that for the most part, cancer treatment today does not cause the side effects that it did a decade ago. So when I'm talking to a newly diagnosed breast cancer patient, once we get over the discussion of, am I going to live through this? It's, how much time am I going to miss from work? I don't have a lot of sick days. Or it really is important to me to still be at work. I love my job. Can I do that? So dovetailing the treatment plan with a flexible work schedule is very doable, but it requires a conversation between the employee and their supervisor. So this web-based platform that we built, which is very robust with a lot of educational information on it, from prevention and early detection, ways in which you could reduce your risk of getting cancers, what should you do when you get diagnosed, and understanding how does that diagnosis take place, as well as some basics about treatment. And there's information how to have that dialogue with your supervisor. And it shouldn't be just one conversation. This needs to be an ongoing dialogue over many months. We have videos to also show how to do that type of role playing. And there's also a special portal for managers to be able to understand what their role is and responsibilities, such as discussing accommodations for that employee so that they can work through their treatment. If you were getting radiation every day for 6.5 weeks, and you call the scheduler doing radiation, the scheduler may book that patient for 1 p.m. every day, which means it's going to cut right in the middle of their workday. But radiation usually begins at 7 a.m. and ends at 6 p.m., so you can get it done before you go to work or after you go to work without disrupting your workday.
On WIPR, this is Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Lily Shockney, an RN, two-time breast cancer survivor, administrative director of the Johns Hopkins Breast Center, and co-creator of a new program called Managing Cancer at Work. Also with us is Laurie Singer Sievers, who serves on the advisory board of the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center. Laurie, what went through your mind when you heard how candid Governor Hogan was in his press conference on Monday?
Well, first of all, I applauded him for his candor, because it's very important to be honest in cancer these days. It used to be the big secret. No one would talk about the disease. I gave him full credit for coming out and discussing this in a very open, candid way and in great detail, which was a very brave thing for him to do. He could have simply walked out to the microphone, announced that he had a health problem and he was going to be dealing with it privately, and turned around and walked away, not taking questions, not getting into details. Instead, he stepped up, he stepped forward, and he joined a community that needs leaders in cancer care and in cancer honesty. And he joined the cancer community the other day when he made his announcement. And I thought back to the courage it took for him to be at that microphone, because as someone who was married to a man who was also part of, in many ways, the public eye, my late husband, Leroy Sievers, was the executive producer at Nightline at ABC News and was a longtime journalist, and led a great staff of people who he considered to be his second family as well. And I know what we went through when Leroy was diagnosed. There were many different layers, levels of having to tell people what had just happened, how our lives had just changed. And, you know, it starts with the family. So I know the governor had to, you know, give the news to his family, which had to have been a very, very difficult thing to do. And the diagnosis, the prognosis, what he would be going through in treatment, that was hard enough. But then you go through the next level of family and friends and who to tell. And that's a very stressful thing too when you're a public figure. And then from there, he had to then think of the people who voted for him, the campaign people, the staff of his office, the voters of Maryland. He had to figure out, how do I do this? And I'm sure his staff began quickly to, you know, gather together, decide how are we going to do this. So he had various levels of having to share this very traumatic news with different people, which was a very difficult thing for him to do. And you could tell in his press conference, there were times where he got very emotional and tried to kind of swallow his tears. I mean, he was a very emotional man at that point.
And I get that it's difficult, but Lily Shockney, I must say, I'm also, after spending some time on your website, thinking, how public does it make sense for a worker to be? How candid in those conversations you mentioned with the manager? You have one of the videos on that website tells the story of a worker who's a manager who says in this video, I think I shot myself in the foot by being candid with my manager, because she said, I've been sidelined. Basically, you know, I'm not on the management track anymore. And people are asking me, when are you going to retire? So I mean, I know you are a medical person, a legal person. First of all, does someone being treated for cancer have legal protections on the job?
Absolutely, they do. And one of the things that we need to take the time to educate supervisors and managers, wherever that they work, are what are those federal laws that do protect an employee while they're undergoing some type of medical crisis?
You talked, Laurie, about the courage that you saw in Governor Hogan. If you were advising an ordinary person at work, you know, middle employee, how candid should they be with their boss, with their coworkers?
Oh, I think it's important to be candid. The most important thing when you're living with cancer is to stay in the moment, be normal, be the person you were before your diagnosis. The worst part of cancer is the loss of control that you have in your life, because all of a sudden there are so many things to do that people are making appointments for you, and there's treatments, and there's things that you have to do. You have to follow a new order of the day. So it's very important to keep that normalcy in your life, and being candid with your coworkers and your office managers is very important. And you need to say to them, I'm not any different than I was 24 hours ago. I now have a diagnosis of cancer, so please don't treat me any differently.
We have just a few minutes left, Lily. What advice would you give ordinary people about whether they're taking a risk in being candid with their work coworkers?
To first understand what their rights are as an employee, I do think that it's important to have candor. They need to communicate with their HR staff to find out what their benefits are for that particular business where they're working. And if they have an issue, which you mentioned did happen to someone that we did video, not someone who was employed by Hopkins, but a patient we've been taking care of, that they, again, do have rights. So we need to educate folks. And the website, as you mentioned, managingcanceratwork.com.
We will link to that on our website. I'm sorry, we are out of time, and I'm so grateful to you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lily Shockney, an RN, two-time breast cancer survivor, administrative director of the Johns Hopkins Breast Center, co-creator of this new program, Managing Cancer at Work. Laurie Singer Sievers, her late husband's chief caregiver, serves on the advisory board of the Kimmel Cancer Center. More information at our website, wypr.org. Stay with us here on 88.1.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Marilyn Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Marilyn Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. A couple months ago, you would probably have characterized 26-year-old Catonsville resident Devin Allen as an aspiring photographer. While holding down a gig working with autistic people from midnight to 8 a.m., he was squeezing in as much street and fashion photography as he could. He'd only started shooting 2 years ago. Allen grew up in West Baltimore, and when the protests started after Freddie Gray's death, he felt compelled to pick up his camera and hit the streets. He put his photographs on Instagram. Then Time magazine put one of those photos on its cover. Overnight, Devin Allen's life changed, and he's here with me now in the studio to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me about the moment when you picked up your camera and headed to Sandtown.
You know, when I first grabbed my camera, I knew the possibilities that there were going to be riots, you know, the type of city that Baltimore was. I just wanted to document it and show people, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, every aspect. You know, I knew the media wasn't going to tell the full story. So when I grabbed my camera, I just had a vision of, you know, capturing every single moment, every single protest, and everything else in between. So the goal was to basically beat media to the punch. And that's just what I did.
Beat media to the punch by getting it out on Instagram, getting it in front of other people.
Yeah, so people wouldn't have to, you know, wait to watch the news to see what was going on. You can look at my Twitter and my Instagram feed because I was posting pictures as I took the pictures. They were going straight to Instagram and Twitter because of the Wi-Fi capabilities and my Fuji camera.
Before that moment, had you given much thought to how you would handle yourself in a situation like that? What kinds of decisions you'd be making on the fly about what to capture and how?
This is not my first protest. Protests when we did something here in Baltimore for Mike Brown and the Palestine and Israel conflict. I marched and took pictures at those rallies also. So I already had a concept in my head on how to capture that. The goal was just not to be biased. You know, me being a native, I didn't want people to look at the pictures and say like, oh, he's just showing one side of the story because he's from Baltimore. No, I was showing every aspect from the police side to the, you know, the Baltimore native side or people who just don't know what's going on at all. So it was a lot of issue with pictures that natives of Baltimore felt I shouldn't have took. It was pictures that show compassion, pain, love between police officers and natives. I just wanted to show the story in its complete entirety, you know, in its raw form.
Yeah, you told Time magazine that you got, quote, got some heat from photojournalists at first.
Basically because they were saying I wasn't interviewing people or the captions that I was putting. And I wanted people to understand I'm not no photojournalist. I aspire to be one now because I understand how powerful an image actually is. But I was just documenting my city because I love my city. This is where I was born and raised. And that was the goal, you know, and I don't think they understood it. They understood it after the fact once they saw the impact that I had and the views that I was changing and the people that I was inspiring. That was the whole goal. It wasn't just to just document. It was to inspire, you know.
And how, with that goal, how did you make sure that you put yourself in the places to get all the sides of the story that you wanted to get out?
You know, just, you know, no sleep. You know, I really didn't sleep. I worked at night, but, you know, I would get off work, you know, prep my stuff, decide what I was going to take, and I would be out all day. You know, I'm from Baltimore, so I knew what was going to happen, where the protest was going to start, where they was going to end, who was leading the protest, where preachers was going to be leading. You know, I just knew those things. And I just basically just ran around like a chicken with his head cut off trying to get those shots.
Were there, though, moments when you were surprised, even with having done all that planning?
Yes, it's a lot of shots that, you know, that just capture my heart also. You know, I love certain images that I love with a passion that I capture, and it's like, I took this picture? You know, like, I really took this picture, and it still is a dream to me that my work has reached the level that it has in a short period of time.
So tell me about the last 6 weeks. How has your life changed?
It's been a roller coaster. I went from being an aspiring photographer to a well-respected photographer in the photojournalism community. I actually went to the Look 3 Festival with some of the top photographers in the world, from National Geographic to Time to New York Times, and it was amazing. I got to hang with those guys and have learned so much. But the biggest thing is just that I'm inspiring so many people to pursue their dreams and also, you know, stand up for their city and their culture and speak up. And I just been put in a wonderful position that I'm actually able to give back to the community. So my biggest thing is, like, I'm working on trying to get cameras for the youth so I can start working with them and, you know, showing them what I do and why I do what I do and try to inspire them also to document their city also in their everyday life, just like as I would do.
You said you want young people to learn everything you know about photography. How did you learn?
That's the beautiful thing. I taught myself. You know, I learned from YouTube tutorials and trial and error. You know, I wasted a lot of money buying unnecessary things, but it was a learning process, you know, and I didn't have a lot of help, you know, from anyone. It was just, I didn't know anything about photography when I started. I just knew that I wanted to do it, and I did it. And I changed my work schedule around so I could do it. You know, and I just put my all into it. And that's the beauty of it. And that's what I want kids to understand. You know, if you don't have the money to go to school or take any classes, hard work will beat talent out any day. Hard work. You can have all the talent in the world, but if you don't work hard, you know, you have nothing.
On WIPR, this is Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with photographer Devin Allen, whose work was on the cover of Time magazine after the unrest following Freddie Gray's death. Only the third amateur photographer to cover the magazine. On July 10th, the Reginald F. Lewis Museum opens an exhibition of Allen's photographs.
Do you feel that you're a different photographer than you were 3 months ago?
Yes.
In what way?
I feel my work has grown far as personality-wise. I think my work is more powerful, more meaningful. Because I always took pictures that, I take pictures of things that I love and I fight for things that I love. And I think I show that in my work. And I think I learned how to really capture the essence of people since everything started. You know, I feel like my pictures pack a powerful punch than what they used to.
With everything you learned over the last couple of months, how would you go into the streets differently now?
I wouldn't go alone. You know, I did everything basically on my own, you know. I would like to have, you know, a whole slew of young photographers with me, other photographers with me. I wish there were more out. You know, I had a couple peers that was on the front lines with me, but most wasn't out as hard as I was. You know, if I had three or four more guys just like me with the same mindset I had, we can do so much together. You know, so the whole learning experience is just, you know, not just working alone and, you know, not just spreading love, but working together as a unit, as a city. Even if you're not a photographer, if that person is a painter, if they stand for the same cause I do, you know, because a lot of people are culture vultures. They went out and took pictures or tried to capitalize off the attention that Baltimore was getting in that negative light, whereas though I never wanted to be on the cover of Time or aim for that. You know, I just went out and just shot. You know, I went out with the right mindset, and I want more people to have the same mindset that I do, to just stand for the cause. Don't look for, you know, don't look for no, like, reward at the end, you know, because I wasn't looking for a reward at all. You know, I just was just doing what I felt and for the love of my city.
You also told the city paper you lost a couple of friends, and I'm sorry. What happened?
Actually, what happened was, like, my whole photography career sparked off because I lost two friends. And I lost both my best friends in one weekend.
You know? What happened?
One was shot 7 times, and the other one was shot in the head the next day. And they were like my brothers, you know. And that's what catapulted me into photography. You know, at first it went from a hobby. And when I lost them, one actually was murdered after I left him. You know, I left because I had to do a photo shoot. And if I didn't have to do that photo shoot, I would have been with him, and I would not be here right now. And that's when I knew that photography, I had to really take it seriously, not just for myself or for my family, but also for them, you know, because I would have been there with them. It was life-changing.
Are they still in your mind when you're on the streets?
All the time. You know, life has not been the same. You know, like, we was together every day. You know, we was inseparable. We did everything together. They were like my mother's sons also. They was at every family event. So life just it hasn't been the same ever since. I think about them every day. You know, it's still fresh.
How does that experience shape how you see your role in the community as a photographer?
I think my role is very important. One, because I can relate to every person in Baltimore because I live here, you know, I grew up here, and I'm staying here, you know. I actually plan to move to New York to pursue photography, but I'm going to stay here and make this my home base because I understand that it's not a lot of people in my community that make it out or reach a certain level of success that I did with their craft. You know, and I think me being a Baltimore native and what I'm doing, I have to give back to the city. You know, I have to empower my people, you know, the youth. You know, it's like my goal is to empower them, to show them that, you know, your dreams really do come true. You can be whatever you want to be because I'm a standing testimony to that.
Skip Sanders, executive director of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, said that your photographs, and some of them, I understand, are blown up to 20 feet in
yes.
in this new exhibit space, in this community space at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. He said your photographs not only help us understand the protest, but they do something else. Quote, the act of self-defining is important in an era where practices like racial profiling impose images upon African Americans and threaten to define their identity for them, end quote. Is that something you intended with your photographs?
Yes, I wanted to document. This is our history, you know, not just Baltimore history, but also the African-American. It's our history. That's why I picked the Reginald F. Lewis Museum to do this exhibit. That's the reason why I donated my art to them, because the story needs to be told, you know, in an entire essence, in a raw form. And the thing is, if we don't document our own history, it's going to get lost and someone else is going to tell it. But, you know, Skip said it well. I have talked to Skip about things, and he's amazing. He's been very supportive of this whole process, and I thank him. You know, but they got it. When I came to them, they understood what I was trying to do. I was trying to make sure this goes down in our history books and is told the correct way, you know, with no filter.
What else are you planning this summer? The Reginald F. Lewis Museum exhibit runs until December 7th. You've got some other things in mind.
My biggest thing, I started a GoFundMe account so I can buy cameras and take the inner city kids out that I pick, you know, randomly to teach them photography, you know, to show them how to document, how to create a good image, how to shoot just like me. I want to teach them everything that I know. I plan on allowing them also their work that I work with some of these young kids in will be switched out with some of my work and will go in the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. I already talked to them about it, about switching their work around and putting their stuff on the timeline. Right now, the timeline that's in the museum is basically a timeline of the Freddie Gray protests and the riots that took place. But the timeline is also going to start falling onto the kids' works, because that's going to be, you know, the present time. Also, at the Reginald F. Lewis, we are planning a teen summit. And also their pictures will be shown at the team summit. I'll also be working with some kids from different middle schools that Reginald F. Lewis is going to put into my hands. I plan on doing free art shows around the city, period. As long as I'm working on venues with Pixelate right now, that will be sometime in August. I just want to give the city, you know, not hope, but also inspire them to get out there next time, because the story is just unfolding. We still have to go through these trials, and I don't want people to settle or let up that fire of fighting for what you believe in, because that's what happens. They fight for a little while the protests are going, but once the protests disappear, you know, that fire, you know, it simmers down a lot. And then once the trials pick up, that's when that fire is going to reemerge. But that fire has to be lit the whole time. We have to stand daily, weekly for these causes. We can't let it just fade away. So with my art, I plan on just keeping people awake and aware of what happened in April and what's going to continue to happen if we don't do something about it.
It's really good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Photographer Devin Allen. His exhibit at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum is titled Awakenings in a New Light. It will run from July 10th through December 7th. Admission is free. Allen's exhibit inaugurates a new community space inside the museum called Lewis Now. We have more information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, as well as some of Devin Allen's work. I'm Sheila Cast. Later on Maryland Morning, a guardian of history retiring. Stay tuned to 88.1.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
And good morning, everybody. On 881, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. Dr. Burt Kummerow joins me in the studio. For the past 5 years, he has served as the president and CEO of the Maryland Historical Society. Next Wednesday, he'll hand over the reins of the museum to Mark Letzer and take on a new role as an advisor to the Historical Society on special projects. Burt Kummerow's tenure as president of the society included important anniversaries of both the War of 1812 and the Civil War. The museum's programs and exhibitions around those two events, greatly expanded its public profile. Mm-hmm. Bert, it's good to see you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on what is widely considered to be a terrific tenure as the director of the Historical Society.
Well, thank you so much. That's very nice. It's been great fun. It's been like Christmas every day for me because I love the place. I love the collections. I mean, how could you go wrong with a 170-year-old organization that has so much wonderful Maryland history?
It certainly does. And, you know, you've been in the history business for a long time. It's the director of the Society for the last 5 years. But, of course, the way that history is being collected these days is vastly different than it was, certainly when the Maryland Historical Society was founded mm-hmm. back in 1844. This Remembrance Project that you've just started recently as a response to the riots and the uprising here in Baltimore, you're collecting photographs, you're collecting material. You're now going to be collecting stuff that's very, very different from the stuff that they were collecting back in the day.
Well, it's fascinating now because, you know, when you're in a history museum, you're talking about the past, okay? And they always tell you, you know, in a presidential administration to wait for about 20 years to figure out what it meant historically. And we're in the same boat. But these events happen, and we're sort of schizophrenic because we're the Maryland Historical Society, but we're so much a part of Baltimore and always have been. This particular, this particular moment in time could be a big watershed, and we just don't know that. But we're collecting material because I think for the last maybe 50 years or so, the emphasis has been on the old stuff, the stuff that goes way, way back. And that's still hugely important to us, and we can tell great stories with that. But being in the present for people who are living in the present so much now with their iPhones and all their other things, you know, just collecting stuff constantly, is a fascinating exercise for a museum to try not to go after what's called the newest shiny thing, but to really collect enough information so you can hand it on to somebody and they can do something with it 20 or 25 years from now.
Sure.
Yeah, it's important.
Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, earlier on this program this morning, Sheila was talking to Devin Allen, you know, the photographer, and you're asking people who have photographs, who have artifacts that were related to what happened in late April to give them to the Historical Society. Are you sort of doing this, from the hip? I mean, is there a strategy here? Is there mm-hmm. a plan, or are you just sort of putting it together one foot at a time?
Well, we like to say that there's two phases to this, and it's very, very important to understand that if you're a history museum, a history society. The first thing is to collect. And they always talk about, well, the next step is sort of a top-down kind of a thing, because what you're doing is you're making decisions, whoever is present to make those decisions in the Historical Society, about what is important and what should be saved and what should be interpreted. But it takes time to figure out what in the world is important. Now, when you get photographs, it's obvious that some of them are real, real showstoppers. I mean, there's no doubt whatsoever. So they have merit. But, you know, people have been asking, well, what are you going to do with it? Well, you could put an exhibit of these photographs out, you know, temporarily out in front. But there has to be a time. There has to be something that you can do with this material so that it is really a part of the history of Maryland 20 years from now or 50 years from now. And that's a very difficult thing because it's very subjective. As you well know, history happens, and then it's gone. It becomes a foreign country. And from then on, you're trying to get into that country and trying to resurrect what happened, you know. And so everybody interprets from then on. And that's what history museums are all about. We have material that's sitting in front of you and you can see it. But what does it mean? And what does it tell you? That's what's so fascinating to me. I've been living in the past my whole life just because, to me, it's not only instructive, it's absolutely fascinating to figure out what in the world it was all about and what it means.
Dr. Bert Kumrow, he is the outgoing president and CEO of the Maryland Historical Society on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. Of course, not only is the way you're collecting things changing hour by hour, it seems, these days, but the way it's being displayed, the way you're putting together exhibitions and programs. And I think the 1812 anniversary and the Civil War anniversaries are great, examples of that. You're doing living history stuff. You're doing things that are not just paintings on the walls. You see that continuing to evolve and change in the museum business and in the Historical Society business in particular?
Very much so, because when you're sitting, you know, in an operation that has to attract people, you have a modern audience. You've got to figure out what's going on right now that's going to get attention and get you publicity and get people in the door. So you really are calculating what in the world works best. And they all talk about interactive museums now. And you know, we're going to a world of virtual reality. All kinds of crazy things are happening with the technology available. But it all amounts to sitting around the campfire and telling stories. That's what it comes down to in the end, because you're telling stories and you have to figure out ways that will really attract people with those stories. So, you know, we did a recreation with the Imaging Research Center at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, of 1815 Baltimore. It's an absolutely fascinating interactive. It took us a long time to do it. We recreated the city, and you can actually push, you know, a touchscreen and pull the building up where Francis Scott Key sat down and wrote the Star Spangled Banner. You can pull out all these parts of the city that are now 200 years old. It's fascinating, and that's what really makes people think about it.
Sure, and of course, some of the decisions you have to make are complicated, hugely complicated. I think, for example, of the governor of South Carolina and Senator Lindsey Graham saying, you know, let's take the Confederate flag down mm-hmm. from the State House grounds mm-hmm. and put it in a museum where it belongs. Mm-hmm. You know, so you've got Walmart and Target and everybody jumping on board saying, oh, all of a sudden we're not going to sell mm-hmm. the Confederate flag. Of course, they put it in a museum. Then what does a museum do with it?
Yeah, exactly. What does a museum do with it? Because, you know, the emotion still surrounds it. And we have a Confederate history in this state. I mean, and the Confederates were very proud of it. And they came home after the war and in large degree took over a lot of the political arena. So we have collections that are associated with the Confederate causes, and interpreting them in an even-handed manner and saying, this is history, folks. You know, we're not talking about modern issues here. They may still exist, but this is about what happened in Maryland 150 years ago. And we have an American flag carried by the United States Colored Troops right near a Confederate flag in our Civil War exhibit, because we have to be even-handed about this whole thing.
Well, history will certainly prove that you've made some awfully good decisions along the way in your tenure as the president and CEO of Historical Society. So congratulations, and thanks for your time this morning, Bert. Always good to see you.
Thank you very much. I've really appreciated it.
Bert Kummerow, he's the outgoing president and CEO of the Maryland Historical Society. He'll continue to work with the museum with his company HistoryWorks as an advisor. Mark Letzer becomes the Society's new leader next week on July 1st. We've got a link to information about all the exhibitions which are currently at the museum on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us. On Friday, blues and gospel singer Leah Gilmore previews her upcoming concert at the Creative Alliance, and theater critic J. Wynn Russick will have her review of Pippin at the Hippodrome Theater. We look forward to seeing you Friday morning on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass. Till then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore. The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Mary Wiltenberg,
Christy Forrest,
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in history, 1784, 13-year-old Edward Warren made history in Baltimore by becoming the first American to go up in a hot air balloon. He didn't go far. It was tethered to the ground. We're tethered back here on Friday. Hope you'll be here with us.